This one is 2094, which is across. There we go.
Jeff, wait for it, Ken. Thank you. Governor, as convoluted as that last appeal was, this is probably one of the most straightforward appeals we'll have here. Court of law and facts of situation, you had plaintiff suing State Farm and Allstate for the actions of Mr. Majeed. Okay, we stood in their place. You had plaintiff also suing the Warner defendants, okay? This is a classic case where everyone's pointing a finger at each other, okay? The critical thing here is that Arnold Wheat, who was the plaintiff's accident reconstructionist, he opined, he didn't have any kind of percentage of it, but he opined that, I'll refer to it as my client and State Farm's client, because we're in their shoes. He opined that we were partly responsible for the accident, and the trucking company was partly responsible for the accident. Adam Michener, who was plaintiff's, trucking company's counsel, surprise, surprise, comes back there and says, it's not our fault, plaintiff is contributory negligent, and it's the UIM carrier's fault. So we are forced to get an expert. If we don't get an expert, it's blatant malpractice. We have an expert that comes back there and says, look, you know, the fault of this is the Warner vehicle for a variety of reasons that are unimportant to this argument, okay? So we had to get that expert. So the court's ruling here, Kills Crabtree's ruling is, the court reasoned Hamernick testified Warner was responsible for the collision. That's partly right, okay? Hamernick also testified that the UIM carrier, I'm sorry, the uninsured motorist, Mr. Majeed, who myself and Mr. Levy and Ms. Cobb were defending, was also responsible for the accident. Again, giving no apportionment, okay? So we are forced to obtain Mr. Hamernick. And quite frankly, Mr. Hamernick did a good job, because we were partly responsible for this accident, okay? However, our responsibility was substantially less than the other party. And when trial judge comes back, he says, the opinion was the same as Ross's expert, we attributes responsibility to Majeed also. The only parties contesting the Hamernick opinions were the Warner defendants, and those parties should be required to shoulder the expense, not Ross. Well, first of all, they didn't bring a lawsuit against us, so we have no mechanism of recovering against them. All they did is essentially come back there and say, hey, it's not all our fault, it's also part of the UIM carrier. We won. Under anyone's definition, we won. The appellate has made absurd arguments that we didn't prevail. Well, when you get a UIM carrier in a subrogation claim where plaintiff Ross gets nothing and all the damages are awarded to the Pinnacle, which is the workers' compensation carrier, by statute, they don't get to recover a dime against us. So on anybody's theory, we win this case. So in this particular case, with all due respect to Judge Crabtree,
you would win, assuming the other case is affirmed.
Absolutely.
If the other case is reversed.
Absolutely. Depending on what the court does on this initial case, could have a dramatic impact on this case. I'll grant that. But I'm hoping, and I'm under the assumption, that the court is going to maintain Judge Crabtree's ruling for the reasons that we've argued before. Okay? But for the sake of this argument, I can't assume that we're going to lose an appeal. Okay? All right. So clearly, you know, he made a mistake here. So there is no issue here. It wasn't a situation where the court has discretion going back there and saying, okay, you know what, Hamernick, you had to hire Hamernick, I understand that. However, Hamernick's bills are too high, they're out of apportionment, or whatever. They have complete discretion. If he was here and had adjusted those bills, I wouldn't be arguing it, because I realize it's his discretion. But in this case, he made an error in this particular case, because we needed that expert. Without that expert, we could have been hit for 50%, 75%. I don't know what the jury would have done. He was an excellent expert, okay? and he was critical to the defense of our case.
Well, isn't our standard of review still abuse of discretion?
Yes.
Even on granting any of the costs?
Well, it would be different if he came back for some reason and said, you charge too much. But, you know, the statute says, or the case law says, the award of actual cost pursuant to cost shifting is not discretionary, okay? Which means, as a prevailing party, and justice says, we prevail under both theories. One, they didn't get anything, they didn't get a dime. And State Farm and Allstate also offered, you know, final offers of settlement for $10,000, which means, obviously, as you know, we get all our costs. And the costs always have to be reasonable. But in this particular case, that wasn't a reasonable situation. Or this is a situation where they're saying, okay, $17,000 was too much, but $10,000 would be reasonable. Okay, the reasonableness of cost at the trial is discretion, and that won't be overturned, but that's not the particular issue here. Failure to award expert costs is an abuse of discretion where the costs were incurred by reasonable litigation and necessary for proper preparation of the trial. And that's the Fowler case. And again, you know, I don't want to beat this horse to death, but you know, if anybody was in my position or Mr. Levy's position, you know, we would have hired an expert. It was imperative. So under any definition, you can come out here with the reasonableness this is clearly a case where you needed an expert. This is a situation where you get two experts where it's duplicative, as Judge Crabtree indicated. So for those very reasons, I think that he abused his discretion. Plaintiff's expert was not on our side. Now, possibly if he had come down with a 90% apportionment or a 10% apportionment, maybe there would have been some merit to that argument. But all he did is come back there and say, you're at fault and you're at fault, the plaintiff is not at fault, okay? And we needed someone to come back there and testify as to who was at fault. Understand, this is a case where they were asking for $2 million, okay? So this is not a $30,000 case where there's soft tissue injuries, although I submit to you it truly is a $30,000 case where there is soft tissue injuries, and the plaintiff's overreached dramatically in this case, which leads into my argument where, before I talked about the invited error, okay? If plaintiff hadn't come up with five or six different numbers for his income, he had one income.
How's that relevant to this cross appeal that we're talking about?
I think it's not relevant to the cross appeal, but the reason that I'm arguing this is because in the plaintiff's response to our motion, they spent 80% of their time arguing the first case. Okay, they barely touch on this other case. So I guess I'm trying to get two bites out of the same apple here. But that's why I think it's relevant, because like I said,
it appears to me your argument is you're the prevailing party. The expert witness fees were reasonable, they were necessary, therefore you're entitled to the attorney's fees.
Not the attorney's fees, the cost.
The cost. I'm sorry, not the cost. Not the attorney's fees, but the cost.
That's it. That's really the sum and substance of my argument. And on that, I'll sit down.
Okay. Thank you, counsel.
The award of cost to Allstate also needs to be reversed, as I think I mentioned at the close of my last argument. Allstate insured an underinsured motorist, Mr. Mahid, who was found by a jury to have caused injuries, damages, and losses to Mr. Ross. The jury came back, it was only due to the errors that we already discussed and mentioned in our initial appeal. The Pinnacle was on this verdict form in a way that, that the jury could do what they did, which is put $239,000 and change into Pinnacle's column, a non-party, and put zeros down for Mr. Ross.
So your argument is you should have been the prevailing party, they should not have been the prevailing party, and then they wouldn't have been entitled to costs.
I think that's fair. I might go a little further and say we should have been. I think we've argued in our brief, we believe we were. The only way that you can find that we weren't is, you know, to embrace this what happened in this trial, which I think I described as a calamity. There are three more things that in terms of why we should either be considered the prevailing party, why we should be considered the prevailing party, because this whole trial, as I mentioned in the first argument, was in many ways sort of the sideshow taken over the circus for the Scarlet Station. And I just wanted to say, because I still haven't heard anyone mention the Harms case, and I just want to say three more things from the court. This is Judge Briggs' opinion, unless the
Supreme Court. How is that case relevant to this cross appeal?
Just that it goes to our primary argument, which our primary argument in the cost appeal is
that you should have been the prevailing party.
Correct.
All right. Do you have any argument that would support you being the prevailing party under the circumstances that did occur in this trial? The fact that judgment was entered zero for Mr. Ross, the other amount, 200-something thousand, for Pinnacle.
Sure.
Under those circumstances, do you have an argument?
Understood. I will not read to you from Harms anymore, but I will urge you to please read this case. Because we didn't do it enough justice in our briefs, and I apologize for that. But it's when I went back and reread it, it's dispositive of everything that happened here. To get to your question, Your Honor, the verdict form, as you'll recall, said Pinnacle Assurance by and through William Ross. Judge Crabtree recognized he couldn't enter a judgment in favor of a non-party, so he flipped it around and said William Ross as assignee of Pinnacle. I don't know how that's not still William Ross, okay, across the board. This was not a situation where Pinnacle intervened in the case. And was asserting a claim for its own damages. As I mentioned, Mr. Ross was just trying to recover lost wages and medical expenses and things that you're entitled to recover, including lost earning capacity, that you don't get on the work comp system. So it was a mixed bag, which is what Bill is the case. In terms of certain portions are going to be subject to kind of segregation, right? That's recognized in Harms. Other damages, there is none. That's why you have a post-trial apportionment. So the fact is, the way the judgment was entered, which we have said was wrong, but it illustrates our point, which is if you're going to do what Judge Crabtree did and say, I'm awarding you these damages as assignee of someone else, that is still awarding those damages to William Ross. And so they didn't cite, and I still haven't seen a single case cited by anyone for the proposition that any of this was okay. Not one case. And again, no discussion of this Harms case, which decides all of this. So I'm going to sit down. I don't know that there's a whole lot to say unless you have more questions for me.
When the motion for costs was filed, did you challenge whether the costs were necessary?
Certain of them, yes. Yes.
And did you challenge whether they were reasonable?
I believe certain of them, yes.
Okay. And do you have any argument about that? I don't, to provide us?
If the court is inclined to go down the road of blessing what happened here, which I certainly hope this court's not going to do, because if it does, there's going to be more and more of this. Every time someone's injured on the job, now we're going to open up workers' compensation files and have defense lawyers scouring them through to see if they can impeach somebody for credibility or whatever the issue may be. Here it was voluntary gratuitous, it was assignment, at one point it was fraud, it changed, it morphed over time, and that's what's going to happen. That's why you can't uphold this, and that's why we have spent a lot of time dealing with that cost issue, because to me, that's something that this court should never get to other than to say for the reasons that we've already indicated that cost award needs to be vacated and the matter remanded for a new trial on damages against all these defendants.
I'm not trying to cut your argument in this case short. I'm just trying to find out what your argument is, and I think what you've just said previously was that even though Judge Crabtree, the verdict was returned and Judge Crabtree entered a judgment which was for Pinnacle, you're saying that should be viewed as a judgment for Mr. Ross.
Right, I think it has to be. I mean, Pinnacle wasn't in there. They weren't represented. Mr. Sarney didn't represent them. That's on the record. At one point, Judge Crabtree asked him, are you representing, you know, Pinnacle as Pinnacle's lawyer? Are you speaking for Mr. Ross? And Mr. Sarney said, no, I'm speaking for Mr. Ross. I've always just been speaking for Mr. Ross. You know, this is not complicated. What complicated it was all of the confusing arguments that they made to Judge Crabtree, and they ultimately got him by off on on this voluntary gratuitous. But the point of the whole thing, you can see from the closing arguments, you know, this is the defense. He's getting substantially better. He's not going to need care in the future. That's not a bill he's going to have to incur. I'm not saying he was fortunate to get hit. However, in the long run, I'd submit to you, not even in the long run, in the very short-term long run, he's not only going to make more money than he was before, he's going to be able to be in a better career, none of which he had at the time that he was an independent contractor earning something. All right, he's been compensated for the injuries he sustained, okay? If you believe that the treatment he received was necessary and reasonable, and Pinnacle did a sufficient job of investigating his claim, then Pinnacle's the one who's out. I mean, this is what they were arguing based on this verdict form. It's the precise reason we have a collateral source rule to prevent exactly what they were doing. And I believe that was the intent from the get-go. I believe that in the joint motion, when they were given the Pinnacle letter and sat back and did nothing, so that they could get up later when accused of having not included this in the trial management order among their defenses and say, oh, it's a standing and a jurisdictional issue, so we can raise it at any time. That's something they had actually thought about this and thought about, here's what we're going to do. We're going to sit back, wait, and see whether or not they prove an assignment, and then we're going to pounce. And that's what they did. And, you know, these, as I indicated, this, I haven't practiced for 30 years, I think I'm 16 or 17 now, I lose count. But I've never seen anything like this myself, so I'm very hopeful that the court will give this the consideration it should. Mr. Ross has been through this is trial number 3 coming up, because there was a mistrial the first time around. One of the defendants started reading and suggesting or insinuating.
This has nothing to do with this, and that record is not accurate. That's not why there was a mistrial. In this particular case, he's doing that to prejudice, but it's improper. Because that's not what happened, he wasn't there.
Okay, we're going to just proceed.
The record will speak for itself.
We have the record before us that pertains to this case. We will read the record. I would ask you, Mr. Rosenberg, not to refer to anything that is outside of that record. I would ask everybody not to refer to anything that's outside the record that we have before us in these two cases. What I do want to ask you is, it seems to me that what you are proposing, or your argument is, that if there is a claim filed, a lawsuit filed by an assignee, the assignee has received an assignment of that claim from an assignor, and the matter goes to trial, it goes to the jury, and the jury comes back, awards judgment in favor of the assignor, then we should look at it as being a judgment in favor of the assignee. Is that what you're saying?
No, I don't like the use of the words assignor and assignee, because when you go read the Harms case, in sum, 841-203 creates no immediate and outright assignment of any part of an injured employee's cause of action against a negligent tortfeasor. The statute instead creates several interrelated alternatives from which an injured employee and the employer's workers' compensation insurer may choose. These include the insurer being subrogated to the employee's right to bring suit against the negligent tortfeasor to the extent of workers' compensation benefits paid. No matter which alternative is chosen, it was going on to say that you don't need to file a notice of claim. But this is a subrogation issue. The language in the statute, as Judge Briggs went through in his order, you cannot read it literally, because you would render the statute, we don't interpret statutes in a matter that results in an absurdity. And that's what Judge Briggs said. He said the tort, it also achieves the statute, workers' compensation statute's purpose. The tortfeasor responsible for the employee's injuries, including a government entity or employee, does not escape any part of the liability for damages caused merely because the injured employee has received workers' compensation benefits. That's exactly what Mr. Winterbord is asking for here. He wants a zero. He wants this whole thing thrown out, and it's contrary to this case. It is apparent the statute relied upon is not designed to relieve a third party from the consequences of injuries to another negligently afflicted, that merely affords a means of adjusting rights as between the employer and the employer. So this is not a situation in which you can look at this case and say, it doesn't matter, in other words, whether there's an assignment problem. Under this case, it's recognizing Mr. Winterbord or Mr. Bean said there were two options. That's because this court is recognizing the third, and it's recognizing it based on tape. And they're not dealing with the third, which is we treat it like a subrogation interest, just like health insurance. It's no different. And that's how you preserve the sanctity of this system and give meaning to the collateral source rule. Give meaning to the Workers' Compensation Act, which wants to see recoveries to the extent that it's proper. They want to see Pinnacle or whoever the work comp insurer may be, you know, that they have the fullest right to be able to recover for benefits they paid. But what you can't have is, you know, the prejudice going on because of the fact that you have been injured on the job. Well, you know, any case where you've got an outstanding issue, this whole issue started as, is he an independent contractor or an employee? Well, Pinnacle investigated all that. They looked at it all, and they concluded that this was a compensable claim. No challenge was made to that. And so I see that I have 50 seconds left. Are there any other questions I can answer?
I don't think so.
Thank you, on counsel. Behalf of Mr. Ross, thank you very much for your consideration in this case.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Winterbord?
Yes, Your Honor, with all due respect to counsel, his argument on assignment is wrong, and it's black letter law wrong. It says right here, 841-203, the payment of compensation pursuant to Articles 40 through 47 of this title shall operate and be an assignment. When he goes back there and says it's not an assignment, this is plain English. It says it's assignment. So if I'm the assignor, giving it to the assignee, I can't assign any more benefits or any more causes of action than I have. And the workers' compensation carrier, in this case, Pinnacle, if, and that's a huge question, whether if they ever assigned it, okay, then Ross stands in the same shoes as Pinnacle, okay? So it is an assignment, okay? So they don't get interest out of it. Okay, and they don't get any more benefits than if they prosecuted this case itself. Okay, in support of my argument, the need for an expert, in closing arguments, Ross argued Werner Energy for negligence. Mr. Bean argued that Majid and the plaintiff were negligent. I, obviously, and Mr. Levy argued that the Werner parties were responsible for this. So clearly, we demonstrate the need here. They pled from day one that we were negligent, or else we wouldn't be in this case. It's obvious. Okay. For the purposes of awarding cost, the prevailing party is the party that has succeeded on significant issues and has achieved some of the benefits sought in this lawsuit. In this particular case, we didn't receive some of the benefit we sought in this lawsuit. We sought 100% of the benefit we sought in this lawsuit. And again, I go back to my argument where there's a situation where Jorgensen doesn't apply, and the judge shouldn't be left in a situation where he has to go back there and read the mind of the jury to go back there and try to determine, okay, what did the jury have in mind? You know, did they mean to award $50,000 for loss of wages, $50,000 for loss of income, $100,000 for pain and suffering? Okay, you're invading the province of the jury if you do that. In cases like Jorgensen, where someone, you know, enters into a settlement, then it's necessary. In this case, you know, if the judge substitutes his judgment for the jury and comes back there and says, what are your economic damages, what are your non-economic damages, and doesn't leave Pinnacle on here, which they interjected into here by getting all the Pinnacle, you know, having the Pinnacle people go up there and testify, then it's a crapshoot, okay? The jury is the one who's the ultimate fact finder. The jury didn't like and didn't believe Mr. Ross. They found that he was adequately compensated in this case, and they came back, and this decision was supported by the evidence. You know, it was a well thought out situation, and I submit to you that this is somewhat of a case of first impression, but being Judge Crabtree's shoes, you know, why should he, after the jury comes back with a figure, parts non-economic, parts economic, why should he have to go down there and figure out, what did my jury mean? When he can submit special interrogatories to that jury and find out exactly what they mean. That's the purpose of a jury, is to determine, okay, we've got Pinnacle over here, we've got Ross over here, okay? Who should be awarded what benefits and what amounts? And if you overturn this decision, I respectfully submit that you're invading on the province of the jury, and that's their decision. I thank you for your time.
Thank you, counsel.
I'm sorry, one other thing.
Okay,
sorry.
Sure.
If, I stress the word if, you decided there was any kind of improper action here, I submit that there's no issue here with the jury determination of percentages, and there shouldn't be an issue of the damages here. So if you're going to go back there and reallocate this case and reallocate damages, there's no need for a new trial. One final point that I want to address: plaintiffs did not object to the amount of fees of Jubal Hammernick. That was one of the questions you asked, and I had in my notes, and I wanted to address that. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank all of you for your excellent arguments today. They are going to be very helpful to us in reaching a decision in this case. And as of now, the matter will stand submitted to the court, and an opinion will issue in due course.